Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Paycheck Protection Broadcast. This is your host, Chuck Morse. Business owners, offer your employees benefits to pay them cash if they have an accident or are out on a temporary disability. The benefits not only cost your company nothing, but you could actually save money on payroll. Employees, get benefits at a substantial discount through your company. Benefits that you own for life, and the costs never change. As the old saying goes, if you like your benefits, you can keep your benefits. Contact me, Chuck Morse, at 617-271-5044 or at Chuck Morse number 4 at gmail.com for more information and a private consultation. My guest today is Adam Pertman. He is the CEO of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency and the new startup, Myriad Strategic Partners, which specializes in management and consulting for nonprofit companies. Adam, how are you?
For nonprofit and for-profits.
For nonprofit and for-profit. First of all, thanks for joining me. Let's talk a little bit about the National Center for Adoption and Permanency. What sort of work do you do over there?
The National Center on Adoption and Permanency is a not-for-profit. It is a new not-for-profit that fills a void in the field. I've been working in the field of adoption, child welfare, for about 15 years, headed a couple of nonprofit organizations, written books, do speeches and trainings and stuff like that. And what those 15 years have informed me, told me, is that we're, for lack of a way to put it, we're not doing it right anymore. The field of child welfare was created, in a nutshell, in a model that I call child placement. In other words, every child deserves to be in a loving home, and so that's what policy and practice strive to accomplish. The problem is that the population of children has changed dramatically over the last generation, and now we have so many kids who need families who have been abused, have been neglected, been institutionalized, that we need to change that model, because just putting the kid in a new home is not going to do the trick. We need to a new paradigm in policy and practice, and that is to help families succeed, to give them the wherewithal to really help those kids. And that's so the nonprofit and CAP, in short, is designed to, very ambitious mission, to change policy and practice in our country to meet that need.
Well, Adam, let's talk a little bit about what that paradigm might look like. I mean, first of all, on a conventional scale, adoption is very difficult for a family. It's expensive. There's a lot of screening involved, and I think all of that's appropriate. We have families adopting children both in the United States and from other countries, particularly China, and I understand Eastern Europe. But you're saying that there's been a paradigm shift in terms of more children now needing homes who have been abused, who have been abandoned, who are really, you know, severely in need of homes. I mean, how can we adjust the system in such a way that we can find them homes and we can find them appropriate homes?
Sure. And so let me give you some statistics to shape this conversation. Most adoptions today, and this is where that big shift has taken place that I alluded to, most adoptions today by a long shot are from foster care. They're not expensive. The expensive ones are expensive adoption processes are of infants, basically, and it's also expensive to adopt from abroad. But mm-hmm. There are only about 7,000 adoptions into the U.S. from abroad a year now. They've plummeted. And there are about double that number of infant adoptions. The vast majority today are from foster care, and those don't cost anything, and there are subsidies, in fact, sometimes. So, and that's about 50,000 a year. So that's the paradigm shift. That's why we need to change what we're doing, because kids are in foster care for a reason. They're abused, neglected, and kids coming from abroad were institutionalized. So you can't have abuse, neglect, or institutionalization and not affect the child.
Right.
They're harmful. But we don't have – there are services and education and resources here and there around the country to fill those needs, to help those families who adopt these kids, but not institutionally, not systemically. So it's very spotty, and it means that we're forming tens of thousands of families a year that are struggling. And that's not doing very much for those children who we, you know, promise a better future to. So how do we do that? How do we change it? It's going to be hard, and it's not going to happen overnight, but we need to get on this road if we're going to travel it, if we're going to be successful. And so the way we do it is to educate people, A, to understand the change population and why we're doing this, because nobody's going to do it if they don't understand why. And once people wrap their heads around this changed reality, and this is, you know, my mission, once they're really amenable. They really do come around. I haven't had anybody tell me, oh, you want to help families succeed. That's a bad idea. Quite the opposite.
Well, no, look, it's a great idea, but there are questions that people, I think, might have who are considering adopting a foster child. And, I mean, I can speak for myself. I mean, my wife and I, we have one daughter. And we would have considered, and maybe even might still consider, adopting a foster child. But the problem is that we don't know who the child is. We don't know how that child might interact with our daughter. We have all these questions. And I think that if there was a means by which we could, I wouldn't want to say screen the child, but at least have an opportunity to get some kind of an accurate profile, that we would probably have been more amicable to it.
But that is where the field is going. If you went today to an agency that deals with children in foster care, you would get that information. You would, in fact, be, quote, matched. You know, are the needs of that child appropriate for your family, with the interactions with your family? So that is happening. And there's more disclosure and there's more transparency, and that's really good. And not just to make sure that the matches are good, because parents want to give kids these families, but so that those parents know what to do. If you don't understand your child, if you don't understand their needs, you can't meet them. And so the transparency is happening. What we need to move toward is providing more education, more resources, more services, so that if you do know, for example, I'm making this one up just to make the point, that your child is going to need once a week therapy. Well, you want to make sure that the therapist is trained in the issues that that child faces. But that's not necessarily the case. And so we need to be training, for example, therapists in adoption-related issues, in abandonment, in loss, stuff that is resolvable, stuff that you can deal with, but you have to be competent to know to deal with it. In the mental health field, we haven't done that well enough yet.
Now, of course, the other side of the coin there is that the family has to be properly screened as well. I mean, we know here in Massachusetts that we've had some horrifying situations where the adoptive child or the foster child was murdered or abused by a family that had taken them in, and probably did so either because at best they were unequipped and at worst they were just taking the opportunity of getting some money for it, or something even worse than that.
That does certainly happen, but the screening needs to be better. Again, if it's just the child placement model, which is what we've always had in the field, then you don't focus as much. Now, they do those screenings, and they need to do them better, but you don't focus as much on those next steps. If your paradigm is family success, then you got to do that extra screening, right? Is that family capable of succeeding, or is it just capable of taking in a child? And so I think that with this paradigm shift in this, if we think differently about it's moving the goalposts down the field, right? It's saying that child placement is critical, you know, and that means placement within their family of origin, if possible, you know, helping those families as well. But if the child needs a new family, we can't just say, well, we put her in a safe, loving, permanent family and now everything's all right. Well, it may or may not be, but it isn't a sufficient goal given the current population. The goalpost has to move down the field. The placement has to be good, and the match has to be good, and then you have to have the resources, the education, et cetera, so that that family can do the right things for that child, and the children and the families have a real shot at success. Then we'll have done our job for them.
Okay, my guest is Adam Pertman. He's the CEO of the National Center for Adoption and Permanency. Adam, when we talk about resources, we know what that means. It means money, and that means tax money coming out of the public coffers, and we have to go to, therefore, the people of the state involved or the federal government and say, hey, we're going to raise taxes in order
to do this. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that. I think it does mean some extra money, but some of that can come from foundations. Some of that can be contributions from let's just say, more affluent individuals start adopting from foster care because they don't in big numbers. But there's also a critically important component of this, and that is that if we start thinking about it differently, if we understand it differently, the goal differently, then, hold on, I need to get rid of that call. If we do that, then we start allotting the resources we already have in different ways, right? We don't necessarily aim them all at the placement process. We set aside, I'm making up the numbers, 20% for training for personnel at the agency who can work with the adoptive family on issues that come up on an ongoing basis. You train your staff differently. The agency itself needs to look at its budget and say, where are we putting money? What is the training regimen that we have? Does it include helping families? I mean, in the best case, worst case scenario, simultaneous, maybe some agencies decide, I'm making up these numbers, that instead of 100, I'm just using a round number, instead of 100 placements this year, we're going to do 90 because we need to use the other 10, the money we would have spent on the other 10 for services and supports to help that 90 be successful. And if that 90 is successful, we're going to get the money back. We're going to get the money back because there won't be disrupted adoptions. Go on, sorry.
No, that brings me to my next thought here, which is that it was a while ago, and I don't remember the specifics, but there was a 60-minute segment on a homeless shelter in Washington, D.C. that did not accept any tax money. It was totally private, but it was doing such a good job in terms of helping people not only get off the street but getting them into back up their feet and getting them into low-rent apartments and jobs and whatnot, that they ended up receiving plenty of money from citizens, private monies, charity, because people want them to do that job. And I think the same thing would apply here. If you had a center of adoption that actually had a great record, great story to tell with regard to successes and how they actually help people, the American people are very generous, and we want to solve this problem. We don't want to see children out there being abused, and I think that, therefore, the money would come. So it wouldn't even be a matter of going to the government or raising taxes. It's actually it would come in terms of charity.
It's a different way of looking at the same problem. It's turning the prism and viewing it differently, and I think once we do that, we will understand things differently. I mean, let me give an example. So the National Center on Adoption and Permanency, and it's on, not for, just because we're not advocating, nobody needs to adopt if they don't want to, but we're looking at the issues involved in those means of forming families. But what we're trying to do is educate the world and then change it. Small task. What we want to do is help people understand what the realities on the ground are. Let me give an example. So there's a common, very common perception about kids being abused, neglected by their adoptive or foster families. Well, it certainly happens, and we certainly need to do a better job. But the bigger understanding is that it happens rarely or seldom. The fact is that, the reason there are 100,000 kids in foster care at all is because they were abused or neglected by their biological families, by their biological parents, right? We need to do a better job of supporting families altogether, and that's the big picture that people need to wrap their heads around. But the second half is that if we do this, if we start moving toward a successful family model, more people will be amenable to adopting these kids from foster care. People want to be successful. People don't want to think that, we're going to have a tough time every day if we do this. So if we set up a system, even if it costs some extra money up front, and I'm not saying it will, but even if it did, the long-term savings are substantial, and they're not just financial. They're in the lives of all the kids who would have families.
Well, for sure. I mean, society would benefit overall, which is, you know, as you said earlier, it's paying back, I mean, 10 times over. When you have a person who is in a proper home and is well-adjusted and loving home, and they go on to become a productive citizen. So, you know, I mean, it's certainly something that's, you know, what you're describing here is not controversial. It's something that all people in this country support. I think it's really a matter of bringing the information to the public and explaining exactly, educating people exactly what you do, because if that were done properly, I think that the funding would be there and the methodologies would be would advance. Now, Adam, you also are, I mean, it looks to me, at least on the surface here, that you're somewhat of a serial entrepreneur. You like to start businesses. You like to run businesses. I want to talk a little bit about that. And first of all, talk a little bit about exactly how you are able to navigate an organization like a National Center for Adoption and Permanency, and also your new startup here, the Myriad Strategic Partners, which looks to me as a public relations management company that's helping mostly nonprofits basically function in the bigger world in terms of reaching out and getting their messages out and whatnot. So talk a little bit about how you actually run as the CEO an organization like the National Center for Adoption, for starters.
Okay, let me start with some background. So my history, my background, and people can get this online if they just Google my name, Adam Pertman, or the National Center on Adoption and Permanency, or Myriad Strategic Partners. And then my full bio is out there. But the quick background is that I was a journalist for 25 years, most of them with the Boston Globe. And then I went on the other major career, I had other minor ones, but was for a dozen years at a place called the Donaldson Adoption Institute, which was struggling when I came on. It was a very good and important organization, national nonprofit, and that's where I cut my teeth on management. I had senior editor positions in journalism as well, so, you know, managing budgets and people and all that, and I had some background. Running a national not-for-profit, no, I did not. It was an experiment. And so when I took it over, it was struggling some. And I built it into the leading research and policy organization, essentially a think tank in the field of adoption and foster care. And that was where I learned to, I guess, be an entrepreneur, because I didn't start the organization, but I restarted the organization and left it in very nice shape when I left last year to start my new organization. And that's cereal is a little too many, but it turns out that that's what I'm doing. Donaldson Institute was my training ground, where I learned everything from fundraising to board development to management to media relations. And that's worth saying. One of the reasons we were able to be successful is that I brought my 25 years of journalism background. So media writing, editing. I'm a Pulitzer Prize nominee. I know how to string sentences together, and that turned out
your byline actually at the Globe. I read the Globe religiously. Uh-huh. So now I've put it together here. So great.
Okay, mm-hmm. and so the combination of those skill sets from the journalism and from the nonprofit turns out to be what I have to sell for myself. You know, it's certainly applicable to NCAP and the work that we do there, which, by the way, is with 28 other people. We have some fabulous people working with us. And it's what I bring, very much what I bring to Myriad Strategic Partners, because I can, in the for-profit or nonprofit worlds, I bring together some, I hope, unique skill sets from the writing and editing and media to the ability to establish programs, do strategy, do strategic planning and training. So I had a very, very flattering comment from the head of a marketing firm in D.C. once last year when I was trying to figure out what the hell consulting means. And he said, you know, to get what you have to offer, you probably have to hire 2-3 people. And that's the Myriad. That's the Myriad model. That's why the name, and that's what I'm hoping people will see in it. My ability to come in and not just do a linear task, but to be able to look at the whole picture and help in several ways that maybe beyond what someone might expect when they hire me.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you look at the Myriad website, you see that you've got several silos going over there. I mean, there's, you know, it's kind of an all-purpose shop, and besides the writing and the press release and the copy, you also are involved in media relations. You've got a lot of media contacts, probably going back to the Boston Globe. And also, you know, there's some crisis management, there's management in general of public image, and it's kind of an all-purpose shop. You know, I mean, it looks to me like, you know, you're really providing kind of a comprehensive service there.
And that's the idea. I mean, lots of people, not lots, I don't have lots yet, I'm very new, but people have hired me, you know, for singular tasks. You know, can you work with us on, you know, as a communications director, effectively, because that's a strength of mine. And so I'm thinking of one client in particular. And so I did that, and I did internal and external communications. But they discovered that I'm a good strategist. So I was at the table for all of their meetings, and I helped them do their strategic planning, and I helped them put together a couple programs and some fundraising because I have that background. So I can look at the communications, and it's really strategic communications. What pieces need to come together within the organization to get this right or to do the job really well? And so, yeah, that's the idea. I want to be that one-stop destination where you can get what you need, and if I can't deliver it, I can bring the people in who can.
And I would imagine that your skills in the area of strategic planning comes from your years of journalism and investigation and meeting people who are, you know, newsmakers and whatnot, and seeing from the inside how things are done and how they should be done, how they shouldn't be done.
It's really a combination, you're right. And then I got to put that into practice, and I got to practice when I headed the Donaldson Adoption Institute and actually did strategic planning and actually, you know, did the programming. And it's worth saying that I also am able in that strategic planning to think about policy as well as practice, because as a journalist, I was some of my beats when I was a reporter included covering Congress, including covering the State Department and the White House. So policy, you know, is pretty well embedded in my DNA, and I get it on a state and federal level. So I can bring that, you know, sort of component into what I do and how I think as well.
Speaking of policy, I want to ask you somewhat of a political question here. 60 Minutes recently did a piece on adoption where they got into this international phenomena of what they call adoption brokers, people who are going to places like Guatemala and literally kidnapping babies or inducing babies, women to have babies, and buying them, and then bringing them into the United States for adoption. What do you think of that, and what can be done about that from a public policy standpoint?
Well, if it's criminal, then it should be prosecuted. That's A. B, international adoption is, and again, this is sort of the big picture education we need to do a better job of. International adoption today, let me answer your question directly. Those are the bad guys. They need to be shut down. It should be criminal prosecution. It should, whatever it takes to shut down people who are doing scams like this, we just have to shut it down. It not only hurts the people directly involved, it casts a terrible light on adoption per se, and is partly responsible for this, and that terrible light is partly responsible for the steep decline in international adoption. So it does much more harm than it might appear on the surface. It's, you know, an isolated case has ripple effects that go way beyond that case. So you shut it down. But so in the broader picture, all I want to toss into the mix is that international adoption is a very different institution than most people perceive it to be and than it used to be. It's rare nowadays for there to be an infant, a baby, involved. International adoption from almost every country, and Guatemala, by the way, I don't know if there are any adoptions occurring from Guatemala anymore, but a lot of countries have shut down entirely, and the numbers are declining, and the kids who are available for adoption, and this gets to my family success model, the kids who are available are older, have special needs, or are in sibling groups. So we're really talking about a population of kids who, when they do come home, wherever, within their countries or outside of them, their new families really need some help because those kids are not, you know, little babies who you can mold however you want, and that's a complicated argument anyway in itself. But moving beyond it, there are very few of those babies. These are children who will have needs. These are families who will have needs, and we will not keep our implicit promise to them, right? We promised essentially, implicitly, that these kids will have better lives. We will not be able to keep that promise if all we do is focus on getting them into new families, that child placement model. We have to go beyond it, and we have to think about how do we provide the resources, the education, the services, whatever, that enable those families to do the right thing for their children and therefore to be successful.
Well, you know, it looks to me like you're setting a very good example of that. You're stepping back, and rather than just simply placing children as quickly as possible, you're taking a look at the bigger picture, and you're involved in that kind of education. Okay, we're reaching toward the end of the podcast, so I want you, Adam, to please let listeners know how they can reach you. Tell me about the website. Give me a
sure
quick thumbnail with regard to what people are going to see there.
Sure, happy to. So the unfortunate reality is for optimization purposes, you have to type the whole name of NCAP to get to the website.
Yeah,
so,
right.
But only once, and then your computer will get it. It's the National Center on Adoption and Permanency .net. By the way, it's a .net because we got the website before we got our .org, before we got our not-for-profit status. That will change, but right now it's .net. So National Center on Adoption and Permanency .net is the not-for-profit. And I'd love for people to take a look, contribute to our work, and that means contribute your thinking as well as any support you can give. I mean, this is a big, big, important mission. And you will see we have fabulous, I mean, world-class people working with us to accomplish this mission. And then my attempt to feed my family is Myriad Strategic Partners. And that's, you don't have to type that whole thing. I also bought Myriad SP for Strategic Partners. Mm-hmm. So it's myriadsp.com. And there, as you described it, people will see the various services, the types of work that we do, some of our clients. And I urge people in and out of the nonprofit world, in the government world, in the private enterprise, take a look. I think we can do lots of good. I hope people will do that. And look at them together, and what you'll see, the common denominator, is really what you identified, what you saw. And that's they are both meant to be the one-stop destination. If you want good service, if you want professional work in the nonprofit child welfare world, you can go to NCAP. In any other world, you can go to Myriad. And the model is very similar in both.
Well, Adam Pertman, I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon. Thank you here at Payment Protection, Paycheck Protection Podcast. And take care. Thanks a lot, Adam.
And I thank you for this opportunity.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. So that ends the broadcast of the